From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A South Carolina college student's recent death helped raise awareness about ride-sharing passenger safety. You'll learn how North Carolina legislators are responding to the incident. The Read to Achieve program has had a rocky start, but one of the state's most powerful lawmakers is pushing changes. They're designed to help ensure more third graders read at grade level. In other education news, some lawmakers want to guarantee that public school students learn about the Holocaust. You'll learn details of their plan. In the realm of healthcare, an analyst spells out a list of do's and don'ts for regulation of telemedicine. Should government just get out of the way? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
2020 politics has arrived. All eyes are now on North Carolina, not just for what our state could mean in determining the next president of the United States, but North Carolina also has a key U.S. Senate race on the 2020 ballot. Now things have really started to get interesting in this race for the seat currently held by Republican Tom Tillis. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. This particular race is one that I know Carolina Journal will be following closely, and Rick joins us now to talk about the latest development. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
All right, we have a Republican primary challenger for Senator Tom Tillis. Tell us about the person.
It's Carlin Tucker, who is a successful businessman investor from Raleigh. In full disclosure, he was a senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation for some time, and the Locke Foundation severed ties with him when we learned that he was formally going to run against Senator Tillis, because we don't allow employees or supporters or whatever, affiliated people, to be involved in partisan politics. But he's somebody who is a historian, someone who's very interested in issues like presidential leadership and constitutionalism, and he's going to run against Tom Tillis from the right. He's going to say that Tom Tillis is not sufficiently conservative, that he's someone who has not paid attention to the federal debt, that he's someone who has not supported President Trump sufficiently enough, which is very interesting because Mr. Tucker himself was a reluctant Trump supporter and made that very public in a News and Observer op-ed right before the election. So this is going to be an interesting race because you have two people who are both two Republican candidates who are both going to say they're more pro-Trump than the other guy, but they've had they've had issues with the president.
Right. How has the Tillis campaign responded to this news?
They've basically so far treated Garland Tucker. I think the Tillis campaign has been pretty quiet about it. And the Republican, the National Republican Senatorial Committee and various other Republican groups have essentially said that Garland Tucker is essentially a fringe candidate, that Tillis's record, voting record with President Trump is more than 95%, and that this is a distraction and this is someone that actually doesn't help the conservative cause, the Republican cause at all.
I think I saw a comment from someone associated with the Tillis camp saying that Garland Tucker is an anti-Trump activist. But as you explained, you know, both Tillis and Tucker have at different times agreed and disagreed with the president. You know what I think is fascinating, Rick, is that some of the national publications that cover politics are describing Senator Tom Tillis as a vulnerable Republican. How so?
Well, he's never had really high approval ratings throughout his tenure in the Senate. He has always been wavering in the 40s to low 50s at best in his approval ratings. And part of that is simply because he ran a very close race against Kay Hagan back in 2014. And he is someone who has not been a firebrand by any stretch of the imagination, but he's also someone who in North Carolina has been someone who's sort of worked across the aisle on some various issues. More recently, of course, he was involved in this public tiff with the president about the president's ability to declare an executive emergency related to the border, wrote an op-ed that was published in the Washington Post saying he was going to vote against the president, and then flipped. And so that was the sort of thing that that soccer fan would call that an own goal, basically, because what he did was he staked out a position very publicly and then walked away from it and didn't really give an explanation that a lot of people bought about this. So there is this lingering thought among some conservatives and Republicans that he's really not as moored as he should be toward principles. But if you look at his voting record and his ability to accomplish things and to work on legislation and the like, both here in the General Assembly of North Carolina and in the Senate, he's actually accomplished a lot for a freshman senator.
Now, of course, we don't know if there will be any other Republicans who jump into the primary. But at this point, with this two-person race, it almost sounds as if Mr. Tucker is going to be cast as the outsider who wants to come in and clean up Washington versus Senator Tillis, who's now considered to be the establishment candidate.
Right. And
that could be a friendly message to a lot of people.
Well, yeah, that can be, because this is going to be the election is largely going to be a referendum on President Trump. And I think inside the Republican Party, where President Trump's still very highly regarded among activist types, the Tucker message may resonate with them. Nationally, or once you get beyond a primary electorate, that's going to be hard to say. I mean, one thing about Senator Tillis, that anyone who has followed him at all will know that he is a relentless campaigner. He is extremely organized. He is very focused on detail, and he just outworks everybody. And so he may not come across as a person who's going to be someone who will give high-minded speeches, say like a Senator Ben Sasse or somebody like that. But he's somebody who really does work hard, and he is a very, very good campaigner. And so if it comes into a situation where we have candidate debates or something like that, his depth of knowledge may be a problem for Mr. Tucker, because Mr. Tucker talks at a very high level, but sometimes is a little bit short on detail.
This is also a statewide race, and you're going to deal with the issue of name recognition. Now, the primary isn't until March of next year, so there's still plenty of time, but it would presume, wouldn't it, that Mr. Tucker is going to have to get out and start visiting all these counties in North Carolina just to introduce himself.
That's right. I mean, he has enough money to self-fund a campaign that would be competitive regardless. But, yes, he's going to have to do something very much at the grassroots level, meet and greet a lot of people. And Senator Tillis is quite comfortable doing that. He did that as House Speaker when he was running for the Senate the first time around. He visited lots of folks. And so this is something that Mr. Tucker is going to have to do, is he's going to have to do lots of meets and greets. He may just choose instead to do big rallies. That's hard to say how that will happen. But that he's going to have to make his name familiar to lots of people.
And speaking of money and fundraising, Senator Tillis apparently has quite a good amount of cash on hand. So financially, he could be prepared to run this statewide race again.
Yeah. I think that's the case. So it's going to be the battle of the insurgent and how well the insurgent message runs in 2020. But with Senator Tillis, there's going to be money. There's going to be support. He's going to get support from, one would imagine, all of the groups that are associated with like the Koch-affiliated groups, because Senator Tillis has been very big on criminal justice reform, which is an issue that was near and dear to his heart and something that he said was very important for him. On immigration reform, that'll be an interesting task to see how the two candidates differentiate themselves, if at all, in immigration reform. And so there are other issues like that. The debt's going to be yet another one there.
Exactly. A lot of people have been criticizing the president for not addressing the U.S. debt and continuing to increase spending at the same time doing tax cuts and tax reform. But as we know in North Carolina, in order to make all that work, you've got to do a combination of spending restraint. As well as
and
tax
Tom,
reform.
And Tom Tillis can talk about that record.
Yeah, he
too.
Was here in North Carolina when this all started.
That's
with
right.
Tax reform.
Exactly.
Well, it's going to be a fascinating primary. At this point, two people in the race on the Republican side. That would be the current office holder, Senator Tom Tillis, and now a primary challenger, former businessman Garland Tucker. And then we'll see what the Democrats might do, if anyone's willing to jump into this race on the Democratic side. Looks like there are three people at this point whose names have been floated as interested in the Democratic Democratic nomination for the Senate seat. State Senator Erica Smith, Raleigh attorney Eva Lee, and former Mecklenburg Commissioner Trevor Fuller. We'll have you back to talk about those candidates.
Great.
As well. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Remember to follow Carolina Journal not only online, carolinajournal.com, and of course the monthly print edition, but also at Carolina Journal on Twitter. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Headlines recently alerted people to the story of a South Carolina college student killed by the man she thought was her Uber driver. Some North Carolina lawmakers took notice, but State Representative John Bell of Wayne County says the proposed Passenger Protection Act is based on more than just one anecdote.
The truth is, this has become a serious public safety concern across our country. In 2015, a man impersonating an Uber driver tried to assault two Texas Christian University students and making inappropriate comments. In 2017, a man sexually assaulted a Florida Gulf Coast University student after telling her he was an Uber driver. In 2018, a University of Georgia student was raped by a man she thought was her rideshare driver. Police currently investigating the case believe the perpetrator has more victims. 2019, in Seattle, Washington, a man has been arrested and facing charges after authorities say he impersonated a rideshare driver and raped a victim that got into his car. 2019, a man impersonating an Uber driver admitted photographing intoxicated students who were unconscious in his car. All it takes is a quick search on the internet, and you can find numerous examples of people impersonating rideshare drivers being charged with false identification, kidnapping, assault, and murder.
So what would the Passenger Protection Act do?
The Passenger Protection Act is nearly identical to the law that was just passed in South Carolina, 99-1. It will require rideshare drivers to display a consistent and distinctive illuminated sign, making them easier for passengers to identify. When a driver no longer works for the company, they must return the sign within 10 days. If they do not comply, with the rideshare company must report those drivers' names and last known address to state enforcement. It is still up to the individual passenger to verify the license plate number, correct vehicle make and model, and ask the rideshare driver your name before entering the vehicle. We are aware that this will not completely solve the problem, but we do believe this is the least intrusive way to ensure that ride-sharing passengers are more easily able to identify their vehicle from a safe distance. In every case, in everything you do, you cannot fully prevent bad people from doing bad things. However, we can make it more difficult, bring awareness, and start the conversation about this public safety issue affecting our country.
Representative John Bell has lined up supporters outside the General Assembly. Natalie Truby is a student at NC State University.
I'm proud to be standing with these legislators as they discuss implementing safety standards for citizens when it comes to ride-sharing companies. As a university ambassador, I am oftentimes asked on tours about safety on our campus. And this measure will not only make our campuses a safer place, but the entire state a safer place as a whole. This fix is one of the many steps that we can take as individuals, as a state, to ensure that heinous crimes such as the one that occurred at the University of South Carolina do not occur again.
NC State's police chief, Jack Moorman, also supports the proposal.
As parents of students, as the police chief, you know, I think, what can we do to ensure that our students are safe, that our kids are safe? This is the type of thing that could certainly happen anywhere. And I think this will certainly be very beneficial to law enforcement. And although we do know that people can have these lights even if they are not drivers, well, if law enforcement stops a vehicle and they have a light indicating they are Uber driver or any other type of rideshare driver, and we can verify that they aren't, then that gives us something to begin with. So it's another tool, it's another way that we can work to keep our students safe. Nothing is more important to us than the safety of our students. Students use these type of rideshare vehicles to get away, to move from location to location. How many times a day, how many times a year do those students use these services? If this will help reduce one incident, if it will help keep those students safe, then it's certainly worthwhile. We have not had any verified incidents of individuals who were impersonating Uber drivers. One thing we've done proactively too, Uber, for example, has a law enforcement liaison. Back in January, we had their liaison come to our campus, do a training class for our police officers. They're very involved and engaged in this program that provides us information on if we have a student who's missing after they were supposed to have been picked up by Uber, here's who we contact, here's how we can verify the driver's identity. So it really, if we need to get a search warrant, for example, here's the information to include in the search warrant that will facilitate expediting it through the process. So we've been very engaged on the front end to make sure we're doing what we can if we do have an incident.
From another major college town, Chapel Hill bar owner Scott Maitland added his own support to the plan.
Ride sharing has been an important development in the lives of college students and citizens over the last few years with many, many benefits. But I'm very, very excited that the Legislative Assembly has seen put to actually address some concerns that we obviously are sharing as a society. And I think that echoing Representative Bell's comments that this law isn't necessarily going to fix everything, what I'm most excited about is the idea of the lighted signs raising awareness so that not only people that would be getting in the actual cars, but people also walking by would be aware that, hey, this is something that we need to be cognizant of as a society and not just take it for granted that everybody's a well-intentioned actor. So while we recognize that it doesn't solve the issue, I think it goes a long way to making people recognize some of the issues that surround these services.
Bell says he's not sure about pursuing any other regulations for Uber and Lyft drivers, such as new government requirements for background checks.
I'm a pro-business conservative. I don't like regulations. But as we move on with technology upgrades that come in and as new applications and new industries are developed, it's our responsibility, number one, as a government entity, is to protect the citizens of this state. That's what we're sworn to do, to look at situations. There's supposed to do that in Washington, too. No question if they do or not, but it's part of our legislative duty to look at the public safety. This is a public safety concern. This discussion, I think, starts here, and we'll see where it goes, because I've talked to a number of members over the last couple of days about their concerns. This has been something that I've been approached. I was at the Azalea Festival this weekend. It was on people's mind down there as they're going to the festival using the Uber drivers. They're concerned. And so, unfortunately, we had a very horrific event happen a few weeks ago that brought us to the forefront. So this is where the discussion is going to start, and what regulations need to be strengthened, what regulations need to be implemented. I look forward to having that discussion in committee.
Bell recounted another personal example.
My wife and I were leaving the garden party down in Wilmington, and it's pouring down rain. Everybody's trying to get an Uber. I called and got one. I'm looking in the line. I couldn't identify the car, so I was just trying to maneuver through the traffic. Finally called the Uber driver, was able to identify the car. When I got to the car, his picture looked completely different than what he looked, because he had a beard and a hat on. And, I was talking to the Uber driver the whole time, but a red flag flew up. You know, whoa, don't see the Uber symbol. Guy looks different in the picture. You know, it makes you think. And so at the very least, we're hoping to at least bring awareness that people need to be safe. People need to make sure they know the make and model of the car. They need to be in contact with the driver. The Uber driver needs to say their name. whether it be Uber, Lyft, any other rideshare programs. And unfortunately, this is a new situation that that we find ourselves in, and so the public needs to understand the public safety concerns out there.
That's State Representative John Bell discussing his support of the Passenger Protection Act. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's Senate leader wants to improve the Read to Achieve program. It targets early elementary school children. Republican Senator Phil Berger explains.
We want the best policies that put North Carolina students in a position to succeed. That is our first and our only goal. If some things need fixing, then let's fix them. And if some things are working well, then let's replicate those. The bill covers in-classroom instruction, reading camps, educator training, data collection, and brings in the higher education community to help streamline literacy instruction in both K-3 classrooms and in teacher preparation programs. Other states have successfully enacted individual reading plans, which are tailored teacher-student plans of action for those kids who need some more help in literacy. We replicate that model here, starting in kindergarten and extending into third grade. Teachers will create specific plans catered to the student's particular reading needs. We're also instructing DPI to identify model curriculum for school districts. The point here is to ensure that best practices proliferate throughout the state. Next are summer reading camps, which can be effective remedial tools for students who are falling behind. It's important that the instructors of those camps are themselves the best and the brightest, And so we incentivize educators who excel in teaching childhood literacy to be part of the reading camps. Executing literacy strategies the right way is just as important as the strategies themselves. So we're asking the North Carolina Center for the Advancement of Teachers to prioritize early grades literacy training and asking them to develop programming.
State School Superintendent Mark Johnson supports the proposal. It's called the Excellent Public Schools Act.
Early childhood literacy is one of our top priorities. And when I entered office 2 years ago, I initiated a deep dive into how the Department of Public Instruction implemented the Read to Achieve program. What we found were hard truths about how DPI implemented that program, and we took steps to make sure that we address those issues. This proposal today will give us even more tools to improve how we teach our youngest students.
The bill has some bipartisan buy-in. Democratic State Board of Education member J.B. Buxton explains his colleague's response to recent reading results.
Two clear conclusions emerged. One, we needed to tighten implementation at the state and local level of Read to Achieve, a policy which we thought had great promise for the state. And second, that we needed greater teacher supports in the development of teachers and the ongoing support of teachers and in the curricular supports they had to work with children. I'm pleased to say that this bill takes steps in all those directions.
You've been listening to comments about the proposed Excellent Public Schools Act. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state lawmakers believe North Carolina public school students need to learn more about the horrors of the Holocaust. Republican Representative Julia Howard recently discussed details of House Bill 437.
Directing the State Board of Education to review the middle school and high school standards of study and integrate education on the Holocaust and genocide into particular courses. It requires the State Board to develop a curriculum for a Holocaust studies elective to be offered in middle schools and high schools. It requires consultation with the North Carolina Council on the Holocaust and the North Carolina Center for the Advancement of Teaching.
Several lawmakers explained their support for the measure. Republican Ted Davis represents New Hanover County. He recalled his own visit to the Dachau concentration camp in Germany.
I saw the rooms where people were tortured. I saw the showers where people were gassed. I saw the furnaces where people were burned. I will never forget that for the rest of my life. And I think if this bill is passed and that education is given to the youth today, I think they'll take a whole different view of the horrors that can happen when people intimidate, harass, pick on, and abuse others. So I ask you to please support the bill and pass it.
Union County Republican Craig Horn offered his own observations.
I, too, have visited Dachau, and I visited three other death camps in Europe. And I've had occasion to see, sadly, some similar camps not in Europe, but in other parts of the world. And many of us are not aware that such horrific things can happen, have happened. We have those that deny that they ever did happen. I was at Dachau in 1963 or 4, less than 20 years after the war. It was not just a sobering experience. It was far beyond that. The smells, the sights, and even to a certain extent, the sounds. I had occasion to go back to Daco again toward the end of the 20th century in the late 90s. Quite frankly, I was a bit appalled at the sanitization that had taken place. The barracks were down. There were just some foundations. The ovens were cleaned up, lots of flowers made to look pretty. There was a museum with a few pictures, but it did no justice to the millions of people that went through that camp and others. Back in 1964, I think it was, when I was there, there was an area outside the ovens, large, dark area, a little sign that said, the grave of thousands of unknown. And today, in this state, I will tell you, because I've encountered them, are the deniers. Oh, that didn't really happen. Really? George Santayana, a Spanish historian, once said, those that don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. We have already. Thankfully, not in exactly in this, but don't believe for a second that there aren't such things going on in this world today, because I can assure you that there are. We must never forget. That's the message that hangs on the wall in the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. But there is no sound like the sound of walking through the gates at Dachau or these other camps. You see, Arbeit macht frei. Work sets you free. I wouldn't call it free. So I, from the bottom of my heart, I ask you to please support this bill. It is important for us and for our children and for our children's children so that we will never forget.
You're listening to debate about House Bill 437, a measure requiring state education officials to develop a curriculum focusing on the Holocaust. Representative Larry Pittman says one of his friends has special knowledge that could come in handy for students.
I had a friend in Kannapolis. Her name is Dr. Audie Christ. Audie grew up under Hitler in Germany, and her parents were very active in hiding Jews and feeding them and helping them escape. So she knows all about that time. And as Representative Horn said, there are people in our country today who are trying to deny it ever happened, and Audie is deeply concerned about that. It was my privilege to nominate Audie, and Speaker Moore appointed her to the Holocaust Council. And she's going to be tickled to death to get to work on this. So I appreciate that she is there at this time. We're considering doing this. And I appreciate if you pass this bill that she'll get the chance, because she wants to make the difference in making sure that people know and that people remember.
Republican Representative Jay Adams warned colleagues that history involving the Holocaust is already fading from memory.
A couple of years ago, I was introduced to a book called War on the Weak. It's written by a gentleman named Edwin Black. And it was about the eugenics movement. And Edwin Black had written a previous book called IBM and the Holocaust. That book was published, I believe, around 2002. IBM did the data processing for Hitler. They collected the data for the Holocaust. And Edwin Black, doing research for that book in Europe, came upon many writings from the United States referring to the eugenics movement. And he couldn't understand why he couldn't find those documents in the United States. And he began to really search for the documents in the United States, and he found that they were pretty much in the basements of people's houses. They weren't available in libraries. And the book, The War on the Weak, is about his inquiries as to why this chapter of United States history was so obscured, so murky, why it hadn't been revealed. It's an incredible book. It will literally set your hair on fire to read this part of our history that is basically unknown.
Representative Dennis Rydell offered another story about a visit to Dachau.
It's a very quiet place. There's no laughter. There's no smiles. There's no joy. Out of the confines of the main barracks area is the site of the gas rooms and the ovens and the anterooms. And standing in the gas chambers, the shower rooms as they called it, the Nazis thought they were doing everybody a kindness by telling them they were going to get a shower before they gassed them and murdered them. They thought that was a noble thing on their part. That's how skewed we can become when we don't cherish life. You're not the same when you go to a place like that. And I heartily endorse this bill. I think it's very important that we remember what has happened, that we do not repeat it. All of that occurred because one group of people in power determined that another group of people were not human and their life did not matter. Life is precious and life is good.
You've been listening to highlights from debate about House Bill 437. It would require instruction in North Carolina schools about the Holocaust. The House approved the measure unanimously. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. You may have heard of it, and your health insurance plan may be urging you to try it. We're talking about telemedicine or telehealth. It's a method of using technology to deliver medical care. But as telemedicine becomes more popular, there may be an urge by regulators to impose unnecessary rules that would hurt its adoption. Jordan Roberts is the John Locke Foundation's healthcare policy analyst. He's been studying the issue of innovations such as telemedicine and is here to talk about it. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we hear those two words, telemedicine, telehealth. Are they the same thing? And if not, how are they different?
Well, in some contexts, they can be the same thing, but as we get more and more new technologies that come in healthcare, sometimes they can mean different things. But at the most basic level, telemedicine, telehealth, it's describing the use of telecommunications technology to treat and diagnose patients at a distance. And that's the key, at a distance there. And so, telemedicine more often than not describes specific clinical care, seeing your doctor, and telehealth is a more broad concept of overall health that, can be outside of the clinical setting.
Give us an example of that. It sounds as if instead of having to physically show up at my doctor's office mm-hmm. or at the hospital emergency room, I could actually use my phone or maybe yep. my laptop to connect up yep. with a medical professional?
Yeah, so that's the most common type is the live conferencing, just similar to FaceTime on your phone. You pick it up, call your doctor, tell them what's going on, and they can decide from a distance whether or not a trip to the doctor's office is needed or, what's the best course of action after that.
And I could show them a picture of that ugly rash growing on my arm.
That's
right?
Another that's another method of it. You can take a picture of what's going on anywhere on your body, send it forward, and they'll look at it at a different time and get back to you. And then, there's another form called remote patient monitoring, these diagnoses that, the patients need to have certain vitals measured. You know, you can do that at a distance, and if something gets a little out of whack, you can be notified by your doctor. So there's a bunch of different types, and, you know, as we get more and different technologies, you know, wearables, you know, Apple Watches, there's things like that that can monitor, you know, like we said, those vitals. There's a whole slew of different technologies, and, you know, we really haven't even scratched the surface of what we can do with it.
I can tell you my health insurance company is actually urging me to look into it, to try to experiment with it and see if I like it. They keep sending me mailings about that, so they know they really want me to do that.
Absolutely.
That tells me that medical professionals and we consumers maybe are starting to get a little bit more comfortable with doing something like that. And whenever that happens, Jordan, that means that suddenly telemedicine, telehealth becomes an issue for the insurance industry and for doctors who are working with different insurance plans. You wrote something very interesting that's available at johnlock.org about really looking forward to what happens as it becomes more and more popular. And you're a little bit concerned that some regulators may think, this is something that we need to get the government involved in.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so what I wrote at John Locke is that, you know, there's some do's and don'ts of telemedicine to really, you know, keep it as accessible. And, you know, another benefit is that it's very cost effective. There's not that overhead of going to the doctor, the time and cost associated with that. And so, you know, the ways that I see that you can positively, you know, use regulation to open up accessibility is that we in all 50 states, you have to have a license to practice medicine. And so if North Carolina and other states were to open up their telemedicine licensing laws to allow doctors from out of state to treat patients in their state, you know, that really gives the patient more choice and improves competition between providers. And so that, you know, the main point of telemedicine is treating patients at a distance. So, you know, wherever you are, if you can see the patient or the doctor specialist that you choose, you know, that's really what we want. And
that's kind of surprising to me because it almost seems intuitive that if the big benefit here is you don't have to be physically in the same location with the medical expert, why wouldn't we allow that?
It's kind of a interesting part of the way we regulate healthcare and that each state, you know, wants to kind of keep their license laws that their doctors in state are the only ones that can treat their patients in state. But
that's really old thinking. And
absolutely,
not keeping up
and
with
that's
the technology.
Counterintuitive to the benefits of telemedicine. And so, you know, that's where I see. And you know, some states have tried to do this, but to no real avail because you know, the doctors in state want to keep their patients that they're seeing come into their offices. And so, that's one way we can you know, really open it up. And then one of the things that I talk about that regulators should not do is require equal payment in private insurance plans for the same procedure done in a clinical setting and over a telemedicine method because, you know, like we talked about, this is a cost-effective and a cost-saving you know, type of care. And so if the insurers are forced by a government to pay for and include these benefits in their plans, and that really runs counter to the benefits that they can bring because, you know, as you go see the doctor and you get seen more and more, you can, you know, cut a lot of those costs down by just seeing the doctor over, you know, like we said, telecommunications methods. And so, you know, that the payment and the usage of telemedicine should be decided by the patient, the physician, and the insurer, not by government.
You know, that's a very interesting point, Jordan, because I think some people might be listening to us and think, well, hey, you know, if this is now up and coming and I'm getting the same quality of care that I would if I were in the office, why wouldn't there be the same payment for that service? Talk a little bit more about it, if you would, as to how it's almost counterintuitive.
Yeah, you know, and so there's so many different, you know, in American healthcare, it's a pretty well-known phenomenon that we have a ton of waste. We have a ton of over-duplication of services and things like that. And so, you know, in telemedicine, another point that I want to make is that, you know, it's an up-and-coming technology, and not a lot of physicians are on board with it. So it's being slowly adopted, and that's why you should, you know, rely on the private sector to find the benefits, find the best way for the patients to use it. And so if you regulate that the payment for these services needs to be the same as the in-person care, then, you know, you've really done away with the benefits of cost saving, of a patient-driven model where they can choose, you know, I don't want to go to the doctor today, so I can call my doctor, or I can't afford to, you know, go to the doctor today, but there's this very cheap method of me seeing a physician and figuring out if this rash is really deadly or something.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
It
just would become just another expensive form of care,
right,
versus, you know, an inexpensive option that still provides you with quality.
Absolutely. And so that's why, you know, in the piece I say that, you know, the private market can, you know, figure out what is the best use, how patients want to use it, and where insurers want to invest, and that they're going to pay for these types of services as the benefits become more and more obvious. And, you know, like we said, it's very early, and we haven't even gotten close to the potential that this can, you know, have on transforming our healthcare system.
Now, you are a younger guy, and so you're of the generation where doing things on your phone, on your laptop, that is just, you know, second nature to you. I'm older than you are, but I feel like I've adapted a bit to that.
Sure.
The whole wearable thing, though, I'm not so sure.
Yeah,
I'm not quite there yet, Jordan. I don't know. I know you're going to be writing about more and more innovations. And in fact, this issue of telemedicine, Jordan writes a lot about. Jordan Roberts, healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.